We're discussing the Kyle Rittenhouse trial as it gets closer to wrapping up. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rittenhouse spent most of the day Wednesday on the stand giving his account of what happened that night in August 2020 when he shot and killed two people, wounded a third during the unrest in Kenosha following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse says it was self-defense, sobbing hard at one point where presiding judge Bruce Schrader called a recess.
And there were there were three people right there.
Are you following the trial? How do you feel about the testimony and what's transpired? 800-642-1234. Julie Bozeman is Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, a native of Kenosha, covering the trial. Julie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Well, start us out with some scene setting, if you would. Give us a sense of what the mood is like in the courtroom, what you're seeing around you.
So I came to Kenosha not really knowing what the atmosphere of this trial would be like. Obviously, 14 months ago, Kenosha was roiled by protests, by riots, by destruction. So it seemed like this trial might attract a lot of that same attention. But I was surprised to find that the atmosphere in the courtroom and at the courthouse and even in downtown Kenosha has been pretty tranquil so far. I think that there have been only a few protesters who have stood on the courthouse steps every day, including Justin Blake, who's an uncle of Jacob Blake. And inside the courtroom of Judge Schrader, there have been days when the courtroom seems only half full. There aren't really many members of the community who have wanted to come out and watch this in person. But there have certainly been many moments of conflict and drama and really compelling testimony, not just from Kyle Rittenhouse, but from many of the people who were there that night. We heard from Gage Grosskreutz, who is the third person that Rittenhouse shot. And of course, he survived with a gunshot wound to his right arm. We've heard from family members of the people who were shot, friends. We heard from Anthony Huber's aunt, who testified about, their relationship and the things that he loved doing in life. And we've heard from some of the people who accompanied Kyle Rittenhouse that night, people who lived in Kenosha, people who lived in West Bend and came down to the city to, bring their firearms and try to defend property from further destruction.
What are some of your observations of the jury at this point?
So the jury to me, Wisconsin's process for picking juries, this one happened particularly quickly. Jury mm-hmm. selection happened in only one day, which was pretty striking. There are 20 members of the jury when we began, and only 12 of those people will eventually deliberate and come to a verdict. Two of those jurors have already been excused, one of them for making a joke about Jacob Blake to a sheriff's deputy. And that juror was told that that was extremely bad judgment and that he would be excused from the jury because it suggested a racial bias, as the prosecutor said. Another juror was dismissed for medical reasons. So we're left with 18 people on this jury. They're an overwhelmingly white jury. There's one person of color on the jury. To me, it looks like a jury that, leans perhaps a little older, middle-aged to older, but the jury throughout the testimony so far for, almost 2 weeks of testimony, they have been watching very intently as the witnesses have taken the stand. They have, sat with clipboards on their laps with notebooks and pens and at times taken, very, very careful notes. They seem very engaged. But I will say yesterday when the judge announced that they were getting a 3-day weekend, we saw some big smiles from people on the jury because I'm sure it's a grueling process for them.
Judge Schrader said earlier this week it would be ideal to wrap it up early next week. We're at day 9. Where do things stand in the trial?
You know, it feels like this trial has gone very, very quickly. You know, with other high profile murder trials, you know, they've like we've seen in the Arbery case in Georgia, the Derek Chauvin trial earlier this year in Minneapolis. You know, it's been a much longer process. This trial has gone relatively quickly. So where we are now is testimony is concluded. The prosecution and the defense have both rested. So what's going to happen today is the jury has, you know, been told they don't have to come in. The lawyers and Judge Schrader will go over jury instructions and kind of hammer out some slightly complicated details of what the jury will be told on Monday. One of the things that came up yesterday is that the state informed the judge that they intended to ask the jury to be informed on lesser charges, which essentially means that some of the more serious charges that the state has brought against Kyle Rittenhouse, including first degree intentional homicide, the jury might be given another option to consider, which could be reckless homicide. It could be something even lesser. So I think the jury, when they come back on Monday, they will hear closing arguments from both sides, which will be limited to 2.5 hours from each side. And then the jury will begin to deliberate and they'll have a pretty complicated process. You know, they have 6 different charges to consider. And now that they know that there will be lesser charges to consider on at least a couple of those charges, I think that these deliberations could be very complex.
We have Julie Bozeman with us, Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, been covering the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, native of Kenosha. Gathering your thoughts on the trial at 800-642-1234. Bringing in Andrew now in Dousman. Andrew, hi, what are your thoughts?
Hi, so I just was thinking that the media from the beginning of the whole thing was that they were dishonest. They were dishonest about what happened with Jacob Blake and why the police were actually called to that apartment complex. They were dishonest about him having a knife and fighting the police and the fact that it was a domestic abuse call that they were on. And then riots followed after that. And MSNBC just the other day was trying to claim that Kyle Rittenhouse shot Gage Grosskreutz when he had his hands up, despite Gage himself admitting on the stand, "I only was shot after I aimed my gun at Kyle Rittenhouse." And it's just dishonesty after dishonesty. And I hope people will go and listen to the trial itself and hear the testimony rather than taking it, you know, from a third source, being the media.
Andrew, thank you. And Andrew there being very disappointed in how the media have covered this trial, Julie.
Well, thanks for the comment, Andrew. You know, one thing that has struck me throughout covering this case is that from the very beginning, Americans were reacting to a very short video clip that I'm sure we've all watched, the clip of a Kenosha police officer shooting Jacob Blake. And obviously when you see a video clip that's taken on a cell phone, and I think it was, you know, less than 30 seconds, a lot of Americans, whether they're, you know, conservative or liberal, responded to that clip with horror and wondering what had happened. I think that what we know now is that the situation was obviously more complex than a very short video clip would have suggested. And I know that reporters have worked hard to get all those details out as they've come, but I agree that people should watch this trial, if they are following this case, I think there is nothing like watching our justice system in action and watching the raw testimony from the courtroom.
The New York Times' Julie Bozeman covering the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, day 9, charged with intentional homicide for killing 2 men during protests and civil unrest in August last year. We'll pick this up back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing developments in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The judge presiding over Rittenhouse's trial this week, Judge Bruce Schrader, sent the jury out of the room and chastised the prosecutor cross-examining Rittenhouse for a line of questioning.
Don't get brazen with me. You knew very well, that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled without asking outside the presence of the jury to do so. So don't give me that.
Rittenhouse faces multiple charges, including first-degree intentional homicide. We have the New York Times' Chicago bureau chief and Kenosha native Julie Bozeman covering it. Stays with us. Let's bring on another caller. Now, Lee joining us from Williams Bay. Hi, Lee. What would you like to bring up?
Oh, hi. I'm glad you just brought up Judge Schrader, because I do believe he's very biased. And I just have 3 quick points. Yesterday, he called for applause from the entire courtroom for a vet who was testifying for the defense. I find that highly prejudicial.
Veteran.
And then not allowing the word victim to be used for these 2 people who were murdered. And then you just shared the clip where he excoriates the prosecutor. And he's done that several times. You just played 1 clip. And that's pretty much it. I'm just really disgusted with Judge Schrader. And I think he should be allowed to step down off the bench.
Lee, thanks. Julie, this is the longest serving state trial court judge in Wisconsin. How has he conducted himself in this trial?
Well, I think that some of the things that have gotten a lot of media attention, such as, you know, Judge Schrader's rule on the word victims, and, you know, as the caller said, Judge Schrader said that the word victims could not be used to apply to Anthony Huber, Joseph Rosenbaum, and Gage Grosskreutz, who were shot by Kyle Rittenhouse. The thing that I think was lost in a lot of the coverage of that rule is that this was not specific to the Rittenhouse trial. This is a longstanding practice of Judge Schrader's. And there's a reason behind it. And the reason is, you know, the judge feels that the word victims is loaded. In a case like this that is based on a self-defense argument from the Rittenhouse side, you know, the word victims could perhaps like color the jury's feelings about the people who were shot. So the judge, as he has done in previous cases similar to this, just said, look, my rule is that, you know, we use a different word to describe them. We call them the deceased or the decedents, or, you know, the individuals who were shot, because, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial for murder, and his argument, which the jury will decide whether it's valid, is that those people were attacking him and those people made him fear for his life. So I think that that is a little bit of what was lost there. But, you know, it isn't often that Americans tune in to a murder trial on TV or on, you know, on court TV where they're watching it live streamed. And I think, you know, this judge has, he is 75 years old. He's been on the bench for many decades. And I think the way that he runs his courtroom is not especially specific to the Rittenhouse trial.
Let's bring on Steve now in Madison. Steve, hi.
Good morning. I haven't been following it closely, but the videos do show shots of the reactions of the mother sitting in the audience. And you know, she's not on trial, but has there been any mention of her role in driving a 17-year-old boy armed with an AR-15 from Illinois up to Kenosha? And will she receive any kind of charges for that behavior?
Steve, thanks. The role of Kyle Rittenhouse's mother, Julie.
Kyle Rittenhouse's mother, Wendy Rittenhouse, I think there have been a few common misconceptions about her role in this. I believe that Kyle Rittenhouse drove himself from Illinois to Wisconsin. He had come to Kenosha the day before the shootings. He had just taken a new job as a part-time lifeguard at the RecPlex in Pleasant Prairie, which is a recreational facility. And he was staying with a friend of his, Dominic Black, who was dating Kyle Rittenhouse's older sister. So I believe at the time of the shootings, Kyle Rittenhouse's mother was working a long shift. She worked as a nursing assistant, and she had called her son that night just before the shootings happened, asked him what he was doing. He said that he was out on the streets providing medical aid, and the shootings happened just a very short time later. But I think that he was 17 years old when this happened. I think that a lot of people have questioned the roles of the adults in his life. I think that people have looked at Dominic Black, who purchased the semi-automatic rifle for him, which was illegal for a 17-year-old to purchase. So his friend purchased it for him. That gun was kept in a safe at the stepfather of Dominic Black's home. That gun was removed from the safe and given to Kyle Rittenhouse at some point. So I think that there's certainly a lot of questions about the people who enabled some of the steps leading up to this shooting.
Julie Bosman with us, Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, covering the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. Gathering your thoughts along the way, 800-642-1234. Mike is with us from Shell Lake. Mike, what are your observations?
Well, one, I want to say he shouldn't have been there, period. He should not have been there. They shouldn't have had the gun. That's illegal. There's no getting around that. None of that should have happened. But as a person that carries a gun every day and has taken 5 classes, what he did was self-defense. There's no getting out of that. It was absolute. And he also shot until the threat was done and didn't carry on any further. For anybody to say that this wasn't self-defense is clearly not educated and has taken a bias, because that's exactly what it was. And that's all I have to say.
Mike, thank you. So Mike, laying it out there, Julie, and really getting to the point of what prosecutors are saying, that Rittenhouse came armed with a semi-automatic rifle that was, he was not legally permitted to possess. And on the other side, Rittenhouse saying, look, I'm pleading self-defense.
Yeah, I think what Mike said is something that I've heard from a lot of people here in Kenosha, that, they are outraged by the idea of a 17-year-old carrying a rifle like that and, patrolling a city street. I think a lot of people have said, that is not the kind of scene that they think is safe, appropriate. Obviously he was not allowed to buy that gun. I do think that the self-defense argument is a slightly separate one. The prosecutors in this case have tried to point out all those things, like that he shouldn't have been there, that they've called him a chaos tourist. They've said that he, should have been home at his home in Antioch that night. He shouldn't have been in Kenosha, which was a community that he did not live in. But I do think that that doesn't exactly touch the central argument here in this case, that Kyle Rittenhouse is saying that, once he was there, that, he was being chased by a man who was behaving aggressively, erratically, had, previously that night had threatened to kill him if he got him alone, that Rittenhouse tried to retreat and run away from him. And another witness who was standing right next to him right before he shot said that Joseph Rosenbaum, the first man who was shot, was actually reaching for the gun and had tried to grab the barrel of the rifle. So I do think that even if the jury is convinced by the prosecution that Rittenhouse shouldn't have been there that night, they may not be convinced that he did not act in self-defense.
Julie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Julie Bosman is Chicago Bureau Chief for the New York Times, native of Kenosha, been covering the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. Ahead this hour, we discuss what the massive federal infrastructure package could mean for Wisconsin public works projects. What would you want fixed, upgraded, and prioritized with this potential infusion of federal dollars? It's 800-642-1234. Let's talk about it. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a unique Wisconsin law on margarine.
For years, yellow margarine was illegal in Wisconsin. Why? Well, the history is a little complicated and a little bit strange, but its roots lie in Wisconsin's proud heritage as the dairy state. WPR's Jenny Peek brings us the story.
Wisconsin is America's dairyland. It's a title we take seriously. The state is home to over 1 million cows that produce almost 2.5 billion pounds of milk each month. We even host the World Dairy Expo. For Wisconsin lawmakers, it's an industry worth protecting, and its importance can be traced through a history of sometimes oddball laws. Ed Peel of Columbus, Ohio, reached out to WPR's Wisconsin about one such law. He visited his grandparents in Kenosha as a child, and remembers the margarine being white instead of yellow. His grandfather had told him, it's a Wisconsin law, so Peel asked Wisconsin, is that true? It reminded me of a story I'd heard from my father-in-law, Rob Howell, who grew up in Kenosha. One of his chores as a boy was to mix the yellow dye into the margarine.
Of course, it came in these rectangular one-pound packages with a little bead of yellow dye, and you had to break that bead and then spread it through the pound of oleo, which is very time-consuming. But it was a god-awful mess, you know, because by the time you'd squeeze this oleo for 10 minutes, it had softened way up. Then you had to squirt it out into some sort of container. So it was always pretty unappetizing, but it was super unappetizing when it was white.
Not being able to buy yellow margarine in Wisconsin drove many residents, like the Howells, across state lines to buy the cheaper pre-mixed goods. Border towns like Waukegan, Illinois, boasted pop-up oleo stands advertising their product to traveling Wisconsinites.
Sometimes if we knew ahead of time that we were going to do that, we'd ask our neighbors if they wanted us to pick up a few pounds of colored oleo for them, and we often did, and so often came back with quite a haul of this illegal margarine.
Wisconsin started regulating margarine in 1881. Dave Driscoll, a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, says that while the laws have varied, the intent was simple: ensure fair prices for dairy products and prevent fraud.
The most durable objection to margarine was that it's fraudulent in that it's misrepresenting itself as butter. And, you know, it's kind of a pasty white by itself, which in the literature is referred to things like, you know, a It was like, well, I've been eating this for years now. You know, it wasn't all that bad and it's significantly cheaper. So I should be able to buy this.
By 1953, only Minnesota and Wisconsin had laws banning yellow margarine. In 1963, Minnesota repealed its ban, leaving Wisconsin as the lone holdout. 4 years later, in 1967, Wisconsin joined the rest of the nation in legalizing yellow margarine. I asked Driscoll why it took so long.
I think in general, it's safe to say that the dairy interests in the state were as strong or stronger here than in most other states.
Even with yellow margarine legal, butter is the go-to spreadable fat in Wisconsin. It's a welcome change for Howell, who still remembers trying butter for the first time when he was 7.
I got one day at Forest Park Elementary School a hot lunch, and I tasted that and was immediately impressed at how much better it was than margarine, which is terrible. And went home with that and was told by my mom that it was butter was too expensive and unhealthy.
But once it was up to him, he steered clear of oleo.
I haven't eaten margarine, at least knowingly, for probably 50 years.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to the massive infrastructure package and what it means to Wisconsin. Here's President Biden at the Port of Baltimore Wednesday touting the benefits of the $1 trillion plan.
This bill is going to reduce the cost of goods to consumers, businesses, and get people back to work. Helping us build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, that where everybody's better off.
That audio courtesy of PBS NewsHour. How do you hope the money will be used? What road projects do you hope get fixed in your area? It's 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
Well, the president is expected to sign on Monday the $1.2 trillion package passed by Congress. You've been looking into how the money would upgrade our water systems here in Wisconsin. What did you find out?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, we are set to receive $841 million for water and wastewater systems statewide. And this money could be used to upgrade things like lead lines, water lines, sewer lines, you know, wastewater and drinking water plants. And that could be for things like replacing crumbling or leaky pipes to upgrading treatment systems so that they're better able to meet environmental standards for things like phosphorus. And then I'm not 100% sure, but there was also $10 billion in the bill for PFAS. Hmm. So I'm not sure if this will also be included as part of that $841 million or in a separate pot of money.
You know, the hundreds of millions of dollars sounds like a lot. That sounds like it could get a lot done, but it's really a far cry from what you found out what is needed for our state's more than 11,000 public water supplies. What is the reality?
Yeah, well, and so this kind of just shows the magnitude of the problem, right? Because this is a big deal. This is a large amount of money that we're going to see coming into Wisconsin. But you're right. This doesn't really come close to getting us to where we need to be with upgrading drinking water systems. You know, just with those alone, we would need to see 10 times that amount of money to be able to take care of those systems. And that doesn't even count wastewater supplies or wastewater treatment systems. So, and that's according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, because they estimated that we would have to spend more than $8 billion on public water supplies and more than $6 billion on wastewater systems.
Can you explain what will be the vast majority of the projects that this money for water systems would take on? Where is the greatest amount of need?
I think it's everywhere. Hmm. I mean, you look at lead lines in the state, that's one big significant need that we need to be taking care of across the state. And it's something that the Evers administration has lobbied to put more money into. You know, right now, I think we have replaced around 115,000 lead lines since 2016, and that was according to an analysis by Wisconsin Watch. But there's still 465,000 lead lines or portions of pipelines that contain lead or other harmful materials that need to be replaced. And in Milwaukee alone, they have about 70,000 lead lines that need to be replaced. So just with the lead issue alone, that is a significant cost. And that isn't the only need out there. Like I said before, there's a lot of aging infrastructure systems that are more than 50 years old, some that are even have pipes that are 100 years old. So the need is definitely great.
We've heard about Milwaukee taking generations at the rate they're going to replace lead service lines. What does this mean for the lead service lines that are on this decades-long plan for replacement?
Well, I think the hope is that this would help to speed up the removal of some of these lead lines. And, you know, one of the things that people have advocated for is replacing them completely. You don't want to just be replacing part of these lines because that can lead to corrosion and increase the chances of lead poisoning, which is something that particularly children are vulnerable to in forms of lead in drinking water and also through lead-based paint and other products. And so it would take a very long time at the rate that we've been going with the kind of financial investment that we have. You know, for Milwaukee alone, they were looking at 70 years at the pace that they're currently moving at to replace all of their lead lines. Other cities like Madison and Green Bay have already replaced all of their lead lines. So I think there's a lot of hope out there that this money will at least help move the needle forward on addressing a lot of these problems.
You had reported that Milwaukee Water Works budgeted $13.4 million for lead line replacements last year. What I'm wondering, with a federal infusion, would the city pull back on its money and use it elsewhere in the budget, or still keep putting in local money, if you will, with these federal dollars?
Well, I can't really speak to their intentions because I haven't talked with them directly, other than them providing a statement to us that they're excited about seeing this money. Mm-hmm. Milwaukee Water Works wants to speed up and put this money to use quickly. So I don't believe that they would pull back on any city funding to address this, or, you know, applying for state funds for that matter. I think everyone wants to see this problem fixed. It's just a matter of, do we have enough resources, time, and money to do it?
This makes me wonder just how we got so behind on maintaining public works. How did we get so behind in maintaining our water infrastructure when it's so vital to our lives?
That is a very good question, and I'm not sure that I can really answer that for you, Kate. You know, a lot of this stuff was put in at least 50 years ago, sometimes longer than that, and I think what happens a lot of times with infrastructure development is there is money up front to build these projects, but there's not a lot of forethought about ongoing operations and maintenance. And so I think maybe what we're seeing happening is that we're seeing a lot of, we're seeing time catch up with us. And as we've invested money in this problem, it just hasn't kept up with the pace and needs of repair and replacement.
WPR's Danny Kadin giving us a tour through the possible ways President Biden's infrastructure and public works package would affect Wisconsin. What do you think of the infrastructure bill passed by Congress? Is it too small? Is it too big? Or just right to address the projects in your community? How much would you set aside for broadband, for PFAS contamination, for addressing those lead pipes? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Danielle Kadin here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. President Biden is out promoting his $1 trillion infrastructure package. We're learning what it would mean for Wisconsin water systems, for roads, for bridges, for broadband, where we're going to go next. What should be fixed and prioritized as you look at the state of infrastructure in your community, where you live? Would your company go after bids for these public works projects? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Danielle Kadin stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Danny, looking at broadband, the infrastructure bill provides funding to improve reliability for Wi-Fi. Tell us what it would do.
Yeah, so the bill would give Wisconsin another $100 million at the very least to expand high-speed internet. And then there's billions of dollars more in that bill that would allow the state to apply for competitive funding. And that would be based on the number of households in Wisconsin that are currently unserved. And, you know, we've seen before from the Federal Communications Commission that they've reported just under 400,000 people in Wisconsin.
394,000 people currently, yes.
Right, that lack broadband coverage. And that figure or that number of people who lack broadband coverage is actually probably higher because of the way that the federal government determines who has access to high-speed internet. But this bill is estimated to provide more than 1.2 million state residents with eligibility to access some funding through the Affordable Connectivity Fund. There's $14.2 billion in the infrastructure bill that would help low-income families be able to pay for high-speed internet. And there's also several billion dollars more in that bill that would allow the state to use that funding to implement plans to promote digital equity and inclusion and literacy. And we know that income is one way in which we see disparities in who has access to broadband across the state.
Oh, so this money isn't just about laying cable or last mile issues.
No, it seeks to address affordability and reliability as well. And so I think that they're really trying to expand who has access and making sure that that is equitable across all different groups.
Let's bring in Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. What is your question about the infrastructure package?
Hi. In terms of employability and people getting to jobs around Wisconsin, high-speed light rail between Madison and Milwaukee would seem to me to be a real priority. It was deep six during the Walker administration. I wonder what your guess is the chances are that it might have a chance under this infrastructure bill.
Rich, thank you. Danny?
So that's a good question. You know, what I'm hearing from the Transportation Secretary, Craig Thompson, is that, you know, receiving this funding could potentially speed up ongoing projects or bring new ones into the mix. And we know that there have been efforts to expand high-speed rail from Chicago to Milwaukee. And there's also, you know, slightly not as much a Wisconsin project, but it does come into Superior. There's the Northern Lights Express. That's mostly in Minnesota, but it would cross into Wisconsin and go towards Duluth. And so these are some high-speed passenger rail projects that potentially could benefit, but nothing is certain at this point.
You mentioned State Department of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson, who called this funding a shot in the arm to allow us to catch up on our past due needs. Here he is explaining his ideas.
We really do want to look at what our modeling shows us. If we're going to rebuild a bridge or a road or whatever, there's no sense in spending taxpayer dollars to rebuild it exactly the way it is if it's just going to wash out again in a couple of years.
So, Danny, what are his thoughts on how this money would be directed?
Well, in that particular instance, he's talking about the funding that would also make it able for transportation officials to address climate resilience in transportation projects. And as we've seen throughout Wisconsin, and particularly northern Wisconsin, we've had very extreme storm events that you would expect only once in a lifetime that have caused tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in damage across the state to public infrastructure, washing out major highways and roads. And so what we're expecting under this bill for Wisconsin for highways is an extra $1.1 billion over the next 5 years. The state would receive $5.2 billion total over that time. And that would be through its usual federal disbursement. And we would expect that to go to fix state and local roads. And then there's another $225 million for bridges that would also be spread out over 5 years. And that's expected to target local bridges, according to Craig Thompson. They want to try and relieve some of the weight restrictions that we're seeing with local bridges right now that are limiting the ag and timber industry as they're trying to move products to the market.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Danielle Kading, who is WPR's reporter in Superior. She's giving us a sense of how the federal infrastructure package would fund Wisconsin public works projects, our transportation projects, with your insights as well on what this funding would mean for your community at 800-642-1234. Danny, my sense is mayors and municipal leaders will really grab for their infrastructure five-year plans, their 10-year plans that might have been previously collecting dust on a shelf. How will they figure out where the priorities are and what goes first with these funds?
Well, my understanding is that these funds are going to be awarded under existing state programs for broadband, transportation, water and wastewater. You know, some of these agencies already have plans in place for priority projects that they'd like to fund. But my understanding is that state agencies will be evaluating projects based on need and that local governments would be able to apply for some of these funds under the existing programs like state revolving loan funds for water and wastewater, and also a local transportation aids that they would receive from the state.
So local governments would still be going through the process of applying for these funds.
I think in some cases that is true. In mm-hmm. others, like if we look at public transit funding, for example, you know, the state's set to receive just under $600 million over the next 5 years for public transit. And so cities like Green Bay, Madison, and Milwaukee, they could see funding awarded to them directly. And that's something that we've seen before with other COVID-19 relief that's been awarded to the state.
Let's quickly go to Alan in Milwaukee. Alan, your thoughts.
Hello.
Hi.
My input is how we've been reducing wetlands in the state, and that's probably possibly affecting the roadways and the washouts and things. Also, I wonder how our wheel taxes are being... Hello.
Oh, Alan, hi. We can hear you. We hear your radio in the background. But I want, because we're out of time here, Danny, you know, is there anything for conservation and wetland issues here? Because that, too, can cause the deterioration of roads.
Well, I think the climate resilience piece seeks to address some of the issues that we've seen. I mean, I think the listener is right in that, you know, as we've seen the reduction of wetlands, that has created unintended consequences downstream for infrastructure. You know, there's more of a chance that flooding would impact roads in those spaces. But with this money for climate resilience tied to the infrastructure bill, that's going to allow, you know, projects to do vulnerability assessments, feasibility studies, and do planning, design, and operations with that climate piece in mind. Mm-hmm. And it could also fund research about new materials or technologies that could be used as well to reduce some of the impacts that we might see from a changing climate.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.